From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, women Democrats in the Senate call for their colleague Al Franken to resign amidst mounting charges of sexual harassment.
Enough is enough. I mean, this is a conversation we've been having for a very long time. You need to draw a line in the sand and say none of it is okay.
Also today, 5 years after the massacre at Sandy Hook Elementary School, a father transforms his grief into action to save lives and honor his son.
And all I can promise is that I will continue to honor my little Daniel and make this country safer to the best of my ability.
Plus, sports with Bill Littlefield and Russia's Olympic band, and the art of a Boston pitmaster, and the sumptuous joy of cooking meat over fire.
I mean, I think it's built into our DNA. I think, you know, from our ancestors who ate some meat that was hit by lightning is kind of the start of it.
That's all coming up next on Radio Boston. First, this news.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks, and we'll begin today with calls from Senate Democrats, at least 28 of them, that one of their own, Minnesota Senator Al Franken, should resign. At least six women, three of them named and three of them unnamed, accuse Franken of inappropriately touching them. The most recent charge came today in Politico, which reported that Franken tried to forcibly kiss a woman back in 2006. Among those calling for Franken to step down are eight Democratic women senators. Here's Kristen Gillibrand of New York speaking earlier today.
Enough is enough. I mean, this is a conversation we've been having for a very long time, and it's a conversation that this country needs to have. And I think when we start having to talk about the differences between sexual assault and sexual harassment and unwanted groping, you are having the wrong conversation. You need to draw a line in the sand and say none of it is okay.
An aide to Senator Elizabeth Warren told the Boston Globe that Warren also asked Franken to resign. Senator Ed Markey tweeted that he should go. And last night, Massachusetts Congressman Seth Moulton was asked on MSNBC's Meet the Press Daily if Franken should step down.
Yes, from what I know, he should resign. And there will be more of these cases. And we want to make sure that the women feel supported and can come forward.
Moulton also called on Democratic leaders to step aside, singling out House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi for her response to allegations of sexual assault against Congressman John Conyers, who resigned yesterday. So lots going on in Washington. And to help us sort it all out, we're joined by Ested Herndon. He is national politics reporter for the Boston Globe, joining us from Washington. Ested, good to have you. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
So really, the feeling is really that the levee is sort of giving away here in terms of Senator Al Franken. This has been brewing for weeks now. What's going on today that is suddenly causing this pressure to mount against Al Franken?
Mm-hmm. We have seen when previous accusers have come forward alleging that Senator Franken had engaged in sexual misconduct with them, we've seen senators call for an ethics investigation previously, but with this one, we saw a shift. As the number reached six, we saw senators, especially Democratic, on the Democratic side, Democratic women and men, members of leadership, finally taking that next step and calling for him to resign. This comes, of course, just the day after Senator or House Representative John Conyers resigned. Another Democrat in the House were also sexual misconduct allegations. And so it seems after that line was drawn and another accuser came forward, that Democratic senators decided to say to try to put more pressure on Senator Franken and tell him enough is enough.
Right. Now, I understand that we're going to be hearing from Senator Franken tomorrow. Is that right? Has there been any word from his office today?
Now, there's no official word as to what that announcement will be from Senator Franken tomorrow, but he is largely expected to resign. When we had Democratic leadership calling for him to resign, the members of the Democratic National Committee, the head of the Democratic Party, Tom Perez, you had members of Senate leadership, Dick Durbin and Patty Murray, call for him to resign. Those are usually signs that they have spoken with the senator and his office and that preparations are being made. It would be in a level of extraordinary defiance tomorrow if we did not see Senator Franken resign. So what we are coming to expect is that he steps down, which would, again, mean that this moment, this kind of reckoning with sexual harassment and sexual assault in this country has reached Congress and reached the halls of the Senate.
Yeah, it really has reached deep into the halls of power, I guess you say. Walk us through instead, what does it mean for the Democrats if Franken does step down tomorrow as expected? Minnesota has a Democratic governor, so presumably he would get to pick the replacement, right?
Right. And so there is a question over the political impacts of this. The Democratic governor of Minnesota would certainly pick another Democrat, and there is a deep bench there in Minnesota that would allow the governor to have an adequate replacement. And so politically, we do not necessarily think this would have a deep impact in terms of the vote tallies, the vote count in the Senate, but it certainly has a symbolic impact. It certainly draws a line that says this is what Democrats are kind of standing for and not standing for, and that it does not matter who or what level of power you have assumed, that if the allegations are credible enough and if people have come to necessarily have come and made these serious allegations against you, that Democrats will ask for you to step down. I mean, this is also, of course, in stark contrast with what's going on in the Republican Party, which has just put money behind Roy Moore, who is accused of very serious allegations with sexual misconduct with minors, and have also not called for Representative Blake Fahrenthold to resign. And he was also found to have paid out sexual harassment settlement claims years ago. So it's definitely a tale of two parties when it comes to this issue.
Yeah. And how do you think that will play out? I mean, I don't want to ascribe reasons for why the Democrats are doing what they're doing, but I mean, talk a little bit about this political calculation, I guess, this stark contrast between the way Democrats are dealing with this and the way Republicans are dealing with it. How do you think that will play out, a few months from now with the upcoming midterm elections?
It remains to be seen. What we do know is that Democrats are dealing with this because their voters are forcing them to. When we had allegations that came to light against Representative Connors, against Senator Franken, it was not only Democratic lawmakers, but Democratic voters telling their lawmakers that they wanted them to step down, adding pressure and saying they wanted those people to be held accountable. And the starkest difference between that and Republicans is that you have Republican voters who continue to back their legislators even when they are accused of very serious crimes. 70% of Republican voters in Alabama, according to a CBS poll, did not believe the allegations against the Senate candidate Roy Moore. And so that's the clearest difference, is that the voter base, one is adding pressure on lawmakers to do something about it, and the Democrats, and one is not. They're hunkering down, they're doubling down, and they're sticking with their own and deciding not to try to push them out. And so that really causes real questions for the future. What does this mean coming from 2018? We don't really know, because we are yet to see really that this is an issue for independence in the middle of the road. We had deep sexual misconduct allegations against the president that he was able to overcome. And so it's unclear necessarily how this will play out in terms of a general election, but we know certainly it has deep reverberations within the party.
All right. Well, that's Boston Globe national politics reporter Ested Herndon speaking to us from Washington. Ested, thank you so much for joining us. We're very grateful.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
All right, we want to move on to the world of sports. With just 2 months to go to the 2018 Winter Olympics, the International Olympic Committee has banned Russia from competing in the Games. The stunning announcement follows the IOC's report about the systematic doping of Russian athletes during the 2014 Winter Olympics in Sochi, Russia.
The report clearly lays out an unprecedented attack on the integrity of the Olympic Games and sports.
That was Thomas Bach, president of the International Olympic Committee, describing the IOC's decision to ban Russia. And because it's Wednesday and time for our weekly talk with Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game, here's Bill. Hey, Bill.
Hello, Anthony.
Good to have you.
So it's great to be back.
It's always good to have you. So what do you think of this decision by the IOC? Fair decision?
I don't think the IOC had any choice, given precedent, given the very obvious mountain of evidence that the Russian doping had been state-sponsored and systematic. They got a guy who basically ran it who's now in the witness protection program here in the U.S. I don't think they had any choice but to ban Russia from the games.
So from my understanding and what we're reading, the IOC says that some Russian athletes will be invited to compete as an Olympic athlete from Russia, but they won't be able to wear team uniforms or compete with the Russian flag or the Russian anthem. What does that mean in real terms?
Well, there are all kinds of questions that come with this. One is, theoretically, the only athletes from Russia who will be allowed to compete are those who can demonstrate that they are clean. And I'm not exactly sure how in this day and age one does that, but I suppose the IOC must have something in mind. Beyond that, beyond that, of course, there's the question of what this is going to look like. Presumably, the athletes from Russia, although they're not competing under the Russian flag, will still march in during the opening ceremonies.
They'll still win medals.
They'll certainly still win because they won't be any less proficient at the particular sports. But will they march in with no flag? Will they march in under the Olympic flag? Will they march in under some sort of flag of all nations? I don't know what they're going to do. I don't know what it's going to look like. I don't know whether there are some athletes who might say, if you won't let me compete as a citizen of my country, recognized as a Russian citizen competing with a Russian uniform, flag, emblem, et cetera, then I choose not to. There may be some who do that.
Really, really interesting. So what do we know about the response from Moscow, from the Russian government?
Well, excuse me again. I think the only thing we know right now is that some people expected that maybe what Mr. Putin would do would take his ball and go home, say, if you're going to ban me, I'm going to boycott these Olympic Games. And apparently, at least the most recent knowledge that I have of it is that he's not going to do that. So there will be an opportunity for Russian athletes to compete in some way. But of course, before this most recent announcement, when people were anticipating what this announcement would be, Mr. Putin had denied this entire thing. It's pretty much impossible to deny given the evidence, but
right.
He denied
pretty strong
it anyway.
Evidence.
Right.
It's sad, though, isn't it, when this kind of thing tarnishes the Olympic movement? I mean, what does this do in your mind to the overall look of the 2018 Winter Olympics? I mean, does it diminish the caliber of the games in any way?
Well, I'm not sure. I mean, the Olympics, winter and summer, have been fairly significantly tarnished anyway by the way that the Lords of the Rings have operated over the years in terms of which country they've decided to award the Olympics to. And
it's a fair point.
Who has walked away with the largest paper bag full of cash from each of the decision-making meetings. So I'm not sure that it tarnishes the games in that sense. But it certainly creates a situation in which numbers of athletes from other countries are going to take one of two positions. One is, hooray, I'm more likely to win a medal because that Russian guy who was, had achieved better living through chemistry would have beaten me if he'd been there. Or, nuts, I got into this going to the Olympics business because I hoped to compete against the very best athletes in the world, and now some of the very best athletes in the world are not going to be there for me to compete against.
Really, really interesting. Well, let's bring it back closer to home, to the New England Patriots, where Patriots tight end Rob Gronkowski has been suspended for one game after he delivered an illegal hit to Trey Dovoy White during Sunday's game against the Buffalo Bills. That means Gronkowski will have to miss Monday's game against the Miami Dolphins. First of all, Bill, I don't think anyone was terribly surprised by this suspension, right?
Well, I can't see how they would have been if they watched the game or saw the replay. I'm going to say something that's going to make me very unpopular among football fans in this region. I think he should have been suspended for longer. This was blatant. It was after the whistle had blown. The guy that he hit was lying on the ground. utterly defenseless. This was not part of a football game. This was a mugging.
And yet Gronkowski has appealed the decision.
Yeah, of course he did, because right. that's what people do in this situation. He's also apologized and acknowledged that he was out of control. But in a game, in a sport where injuries to the players have become a larger story than who happens to win on any given Sunday, and specifically head injuries, but this year also all sorts of other injuries that have accounted for the departure of any number of top-flight players, the kind of people that draw people into the stands. This is the kind of story that cannot be, or the kind of act, I should say, that cannot be sort of brushed aside, oh, yeah, one-game suspension. And I think particularly with the Patriots, they're very deep. They're going to win the game anyway. It's not going to hurt anybody much. People have talked a little bit about how much money Gronkowski is going to lose. But in the great scheme of things, the way athletes are paid these days, even that doesn't mean a whole heck of a lot.
Yeah, we should mention in terms of how much money he's going to lose, $281,000 for 1 week off. That's mm-hmm. what it will cost him. So in other football news, New York Giants quarterback Eli Manning was benched last weekend for the first time since 2004, breaking his 210 game streak of starting for the Giants. What do you make of his benching?
Well, I think it's kind of a shame. They bench him for 1 week and they're going to bring him back again this weekend. That hardly seems fair. I mean, if they're going to, you know, they fired the people who benched him, and so he's going to be back. But it's kind of a shame. Streaks are good. Makes people pay attention and care.
All right. Well, that's Bill Littlefield, who always makes us care. He's host of NPR's Only a Game. It airs right here on WBUR Saturdays at 7 in the morning and again at 7 p.m. Bill, as always, thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you, Anthony.
Stay with us. Coming up 5 years after the massacre at Sandy Hook Elementary School, a father transforms his grief into action to save lives and to honor his son. Stay with us. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. Next Thursday, December 14th, marks a grim anniversary. It will be 5 years since a young man walked into the Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, Connecticut, and shot and killed 20 children between the ages of 6 and 7 years old, along with 6 educators. The killings left the mothers and fathers, the brothers and sisters, and the partners of the victims to cope with a long and painful period of grief. We're going to hear now from a Sandy Hook father who transformed that grief into action in an effort to save lives and honor his son. A few weeks ago, I drove down to Newtown to meet Mark Barden, where we sat down to talk, and the first thing he did was show me a picture.
This was the life that we knew and loved and enjoyed prior to that morning, and this is a picture of my 3 children, James and Natalie and Daniel, hugging and smiling.
James, Natalie, and Daniel, 12, 10, and 6 in the pictures, have big, wide smiles. Their dad says Daniel loved animals, even insects and worms, so much so that he and his wife Jackie called him the caretaker of all living things. Mark Barden told me about that cold December morning 5 years ago when he walked his oldest son, James, down the driveway to catch the early school bus.
And I hear little footsteps behind me, and it's Daniel. I say, what are you doing up? And he was just out there in his little pajamas, put flip-flops on. I said, it's cold. What are you doing? He said, I want to come with you to the bus so I can hug James and tell him I love him. And so we did that. We walked to the bus, and he wrapped his little arms around James and hugged him and told him he loved him. And we got back to the house, and I said, you know, it's still early. You can go back to bed if you want. You don't have to be up for a while. And he said, no, Daddy, this gives us more time for cuddling. So we got on the couch, and we cuddled. I turned on the Christmas tree lights, and we were wrestling on the couch, and he notices the sunrise outside the window. And he said, look at how beautiful the sunrise is this morning, Dad. And you can see the reflection of our Christmas tree lights in the window against the beautiful sunrise. And I thought, that is beautiful. And I thought, what kid notices that? What 7-year-old kid notices that? So I went and got the camera. And so I have this picture of that beautiful sunrise with our Christmas tree lights reflected in the window. Mm-hmm. And then he had to walk Natalie to the bus, and he wanted to tell her that he loved her as well. Daniel and I enjoyed our little quiet alone time in that last hour, but we walked to the bus, and I hugged him and kissed him and told him I loved him. I went back to the house I started getting texts and emails and phone calls that there was a lockdown in the district, and then more detailed information that there were reports of a shooting. So I get in the car and I fly down to the school, and I come upon this scene, more emergency vehicles and personnel than I've ever seen in my life.
As you waited to find out, I have to imagine that some families are being reunited with their kids, and then the families who lost their children waiting and waiting and waiting.
So, yeah, there's a firehouse down the road from the school that they had moved the equipment out of the garage, and they were assembling the classes by grade, and there were people holding up signs indicating what grade should line up there. And I kept circling around the one for the first grade looking for Daniel, and no Daniel. That's when we learned what had happened, and that a gunman had shot his way into the school and shot and killed 6 educators and 20 first grade children. And this sweet little boy, the caretaker of all living things, the light of happiness in our little family, was among those 20 first grade children who had been shot to death.
In those days that followed, I mean, what was the immediate nature of those days that got you and your wife and your kids through those days?
I award all of the credit for getting us through those days with our close and beautiful family and our wonderful community here in Newtown. My wife Jackie is one of 10, so we have she has a lot of siblings, and we have a lot of nieces and nephews, and they all kind of came to us and wrapped themselves around us in those days and weeks, really. You know, a lot of people who suffer this tragedy in communities and cities across this country every day don't have that. They don't have any of the resources. They don't even have people that know about it or care about it. So I consider that such a blessing. I still rely heavily on my family. I even rely on my James and Natalie. You know, in those first weeks, my wife Jackie and I would be collapsed on literally on the floor in a heap, just sobbing and crying, you know, both of us whispering to each other, I just want to die. And James and Natalie would come find us, and they'd wrap their arms around us and hold us and kind of bring us strength, which is kind of the reverse what you might think.
And remind me, how old were they then?
12 and 10. James was 12 and Natalie was 10.
I want to ask you about Sandy Hook Promise and sort of the journey that brought you to setting up this organization. And at what point did it become clear that you wanted to do something, create something, I guess, that could transcend this tragedy and honor Daniel's memory?
The idea that, like it or not, that I was on a platform and I had a voice and I have this horrible experience now that I was going to be living with for the rest of my life, that I had an opportunity, I guess, based on that experience to affect some kind of change and to prevent this from happening to another family. And as that idea began to develop and crystallize within my soul and psyche, I realized that I can't not do that. I don't have a choice. I can't just say, it's too hard. So a few families who had suffered the loss in that devastation came on board with this. A few of them came on and then left, and a few of them stayed. And this organization began to take shape. And we found an aspect of this gun violence prevention work that had not been really being addressed, which is the whole idea of prevention.
So say a little bit more about that, of how the prevention piece works. I mean, what you're focused on.
Pretty much everything that we do does have a nexus back specifically to what happened here in Newtown, but a lot of those components are also common to most other mass shootings and in other forms of violence and other forms of social issues as well. So we have developed 4 programs that we can bring into schools and youth-serving organizations and communities that teach people how to recognize the signs and signals of somebody who is thinking about hurting themselves or somebody else, and then get them to the help that they need before it becomes a tragedy, before the gun is even in the equation. You know, if you think about what happened in Sandy Hook, and I do all the time, and I think about how could this have been prevented. Number one, it was preventable. If I could go back in time, and if we could have had our programs in place in a way that would have reached that shooter, I'm convinced that this would never have happened. We can, in effect, wind back the clock before another tragedy happens and get that person to the help that they need. The individual that shot and killed Daniel was chronically socially isolated. One of our programs is called Start With Hello.
Start With Hello.
Start With Hello. Reach out to somebody who is chronically socially isolated, who was always left out, who was always ignored, as was the case with the shooter in Sandy Hook, and make them feel included. We provide that program free of charge to schools, where it's a wonderful training that the kids take, and they own it, and they run it. The next program is Say Something, which trains kids, mostly in social media, but it could be applied to the lunchroom or the school bus or the cafeteria, you know, the playground. Trains kids, it teaches them, it gives them the tools to know the signs that are present in social media, and then take the next step to get that person help. The kids are the eyes and the ears and all these different social media platforms, and they see things that we don't. You know, we have case story after case history of somebody who talked about suicide for months, and hundreds of tweets and social media impressions. Nobody stepped in and did anything. So we're able to teach kids how to recognize those signs and signals and then take the next step. We also have an anonymous reporting system, which is an app they can put on their phone. It takes away any of the implications of being a rat or a snitch or whatever it is that prevents kids from taking that next step. We've actually stopped school shootings with that program.
How do you know about that?
Well, we have a couple of cases, and we built this program. We've tested it at length in Ohio. And so we have a presence all through Ohio. And I was out in Ohio doing a parent-teacher conference after we had done a training in a middle school there. And I was walking out to my car, and the guidance counselor literally chased me down in tears and saying, "We just had an episode. We just had an incident averted because of your training." And it was an eighth-grade girl who had taken the Say Something training. She saw something in social media and said, "This is something that I would not have thought twice about before my training," and followed the model. And they uncovered a horrible plan that was all ready to be executed and stop it before it happened.
And this was a plan a young person had to shoot and kill specifically?
Well, yeah, it was something like that. And I'm not sure how many of the details I'm allowed to disclose at this point, because this may be still an ongoing case. But yes.
You said something, and it comes back to your son, where someone like Daniel, if he had had contact with the shooter at some point and spoken to him, it may have prevented the outcome. I mean, it's such a simple idea, a compassionate kid sitting down with someone and saying, "Hi."
I will tell you, at every one of Daniel's parent-teacher conferences, we would hear that same story, that if Daniel sees somebody who's been left out, sitting alone, he asks to be excused from an activity to go sit with them and just make sure they're okay. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I mean, you have to think, especially now after we've studied this and we've done all this research on that, that somebody who is chronically socially isolated for an extended period of time is at absolutely increased risk of causing or being the victim of violence. So I have to wonder if maybe one more conversation with that individual by somebody like Daniel, who initiated that conversation, might have made all the difference. Here's a story I'll share with you. My niece Jackie lives in Mount Airy, Maryland, with her two children and her husband. And at the time, her oldest daughter, Mariah, was 16. And after they had gone back home to Maryland after coming up here for Daniel's services, Mariah said, thought to herself in class, "You know, I know of this kid who's always left out, who's always ignored." And she thought to herself, "What would Daniel do? What would my little cousin do?" And she thought Daniel would go talk to him. Got up and went over and just said a few words, introduced herself to this kid and had a brief conversation with him. And that was all. And she just felt like, that's, you know, a way I can honor my little cousin Daniel. At the end of the day, at the chaos of dismissal, this same kid found Mariah and tapped her on the shoulder and said, "What was your name again? Thank you so much for talking to me. You're so nice." And that's how you're going to create something that's going to capture those people who might be on that path to something very horrible that we saw in Las Vegas or in Orlando or in Virginia Tech or Columbine. You know, that's how we're going to reach those people.
What about the guns? You said, isn't that a problem? It seems like just dealing with prevention is just sort of saying, well, the guns are just going to be there and there's nothing we can do about it.
The guns are there, but there are things we can do about it. There are so many things. There are policy initiatives around firearms that we feel complement our work. For example, there is a piece of legislation that is called an extreme risk protection order. And it's a targeted behavioral approach at saving lives. And what it does is that it gives the tools to individuals who recognize a family member who is potentially in a crisis, who is thinking about hurting themselves or hurting somebody else. It gives a family member the tools to then petition the court or the authorities and say, I think this person needs help. And then the court can issue an order to say, we are going to temporarily, if you own firearms, we're going to temporarily store your firearms somewhere else until you are okay. And then there's a due process where that person can appeal to have their property restored to them. It doesn't take away their rights, but it will empower families to save lives. Massachusetts is next in line. States are enacting this. Oregon just passed this statewide. Other states, Connecticut has it. California has it.
You mentioned a moment ago a short list. Of course, the list is much longer, but Orlando, Virginia Tech, Las Vegas, Columbine. Does it make you feel that in spite of this kind of work, you know, here we are again and again and again? I mean, how do you process that?
It brings back all kinds of horrible memories of the days following the massacre that took the life of my little Daniel. This is hard, hard work for me, you know, because I'm immersed in the dynamics and the social issues that led to my son's murder every day. It's very discouraging. And I've used the word defeated in conversations. But I do know that the work that we are doing, that we have stopped school shootings as a direct result of our work. I know that we have prevented suicides as a direct result of our work. And all I can promise is that I will continue to honor my little Daniel. And I will continue to do everything in my power to protect my children and your children and make this country safer to the best of my ability.
That's Mark Barden, the father of Daniel Barden, who was among 20 children and 6 educators who were murdered at Sandy Hook Elementary School 5 years ago. The anniversary actually falls next Thursday. He's also the co-founder of Sandy Hook Promise, which has trained more than 2 million people in all 50 states. There's a bunch more information about all this at radioboston.org. Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Anthony Brooks, and this is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. How much do you know about the lives of your grandparents or about your great-grandparents? WBUR's Erica Lance has this kind world story of one woman's search for the history of her own grandmother.
Rachel Cerati grew up in Boston, and she remembers the day she started to feel like an adult. She was a college student and visiting her grandmother, Hannah Dubova, outside of Philadelphia.
She had this box of wine, and it was, like, only slightly expired red wine. So we each poured, like, a cup, and we went to sit on her porch, and it overlooks this parking lot.
They were there for a reason. Rachel wanted to hear her grandmother's story. She knew parts already. Her grandmother was a Jewish Holocaust survivor from Czechoslovakia.
My grandmother had so much to say, and I don't think that many people asked her questions.
So Rachel started asking. And over the next year, the two of them sat down for oral histories. Hannah's health deteriorated that year. At the end of it, at age 85, she died. She left behind a mass of diaries, letters, and photographs. And Rachel became obsessed with digging deeper into her grandmother's past. She decided to spend the coming years retracing her grandmother's footsteps.
Hannah was born in 1925 in Czechoslovakia.
Hannah's father owned a shop on Prague's main square when Hitler came to power.
They thought that it could never happen here, that anti-Semitism was just a rumor. By the time they realized it could happen here, it was too late.
Hannah's family applied to come to the U.S., but
nobody wanted these refugees, soon-to-be refugees.
Then came a sliver of hope.
The Danish government agreed to take in a set number of Czech Jewish children between the ages of 14 and 16 and put them on foster farms in Denmark. And Hannah was chosen.
soon 14-year-old Hannah was at a train station, saying goodbye to her family. She thought the war would be over soon. But in a few years, her parents and her little brother would be murdered in an extermination camp. When Hannah arrived in Denmark, the Danish program placed her on 3 foster farms that hosted her for 6 months each.
For the first 2 farms that Hannah was on, so her first year in Denmark, she was with families that she didn't feel like treated her very well. She wasn't allowed to eat with the family. She had to live upstairs in the attic that was unheated. She wrote about her sheets freezing in the night.
But everything changed when Hannah moved in with a young couple and their newborn.
They treated her like family.
For the first time in ages, she found herself skipping around, singing.
In her letters, she talks about all of a sudden feeling at home. And she hadn't said that in years.
So, decades later, Rachel tracked down that family. And she asked to live on the farm of their descendants, just as her grandmother had. The farm belonged to Sine Christensen and her husband. Sine's grandmother had hosted Rachel's grandmother 74 years before.
We all knew the story, but it became different when I met Rachel.
That's Sine. Her grandmother had often wondered what had happened to that refugee from Czechoslovakia.
And I come into their house and, you know, just casually they put, you know, a pot of coffee on the table and we just sit and chat.
We talked about our grandmoms and we started to feel a little connected or in family or something because of their connection. I think they had a special bond.
Rachel moved in and helped Sine with farm work, just as their grandmothers had done. They laughed, they cooked, they even sang together. And gradually, Rachel felt like one of them.
You know, I'm reading words that my grandmother wrote about this family from 1941. And it's like I could take those words and put them into my diary today about their descendants.
Rachel's grandmother, Hannah, was able to safely stay in Denmark until she was 17, when a stranger appeared.
This guy showed up on a bike who she did not know.
He was part of the Danish underground. They'd heard that Nazis were about to round up Jews in the area.
And he says she needs to come with me, and pretty much gave her 5 minutes to pack up what she could.
He hid her in a church attic for 3 days. And then, one night, a fisherman smuggled Hannah and more than a dozen other refugees to Sweden by hiding them under piles of herring in his boat.
We hear about all this, like, horrific details over and over again, but there are these, like, stories that compete with that where it's like, yeah, but look what you can do that can save people. I mean, it's a really different story than friends of mine whose grandparents were in concentration camps. Like, Hannah was never in a camp because people kept her safe, because people, you know, honored her life as a human.
For Rachel, history keeps circling back to the present. In 2016, as part of her research, she visited the place where the fisherman's boat landed in Sweden. She found a surreal scene.
There's young refugees, unaccompanied refugees, living in the same building again that Hannah spent her first night as a refugee in Sweden, same age, without parents. One day, those kids who are finding refuge in Sweden are going to be grandparents. Either we give them a narrative to tell their grandchildren about how people were wonderful and helped us and treated us with respect and kindness, or we can hand them a narrative about hate and fear.
For her part, Rachel's still close with the people who helped her grandmother. In 2016, when she got married, she celebrated the wedding at Sine's farm with the descendants of the people who gave Hannah a home. By then, they all felt like family.
I remember Sine turning to me and saying, you know, I think our grandmothers are smiling down at us. That's just like what it feels like. The beauty that's come out of such tragedy has become perhaps the most important part of my grandmother's story.
Rachel has spent her entire adult life in her grandmother's past. And the deeper she goes, the more she finds hope for the future.
And that kind world story about Rachel Cerati's grandmother comes from WBUR's Erica Lance. Finally today, we noticed a bit of food news this week that made us, well, hungry. Chef Andy Husbands, who's been on this show a number of times to talk about farm-to-table cooking, has expanded The Smoke Shop, his popular barbecue restaurant in Kendall Square. The new location is in Boston's Fort Point neighborhood. It's massive, 180 seats and more than 200 American whiskeys. But the real stars are the ribs, the brisket, glazed chicken thighs, pulled pork, and crispy burnt ends, what we like to call meat candy. Mmm. So, we wanted to revisit and retaste some of that great comfort food with a conversation we had with Andy Husbands and Chris Hart last spring. More than 20 years ago, the two of them, they were high school buddies. They opened Tremont 647 in the South End. Since then, they've gone deep into barbecue, even participating in barbecue competitions. We met up with them at the original smoke shop in Kendall Square to discuss their book, Pitmaster, Recipes, Techniques, and Barbecue Wisdom. Here's Chris Hart.
Over the years, we've been inspired by various barbecue regions, so we kind of dug into those regions and met pitmasters and learned about not just how do they cook the food, but how did they end up dedicating essentially their lives to cooking meat with fire.
And what attracts you both to that? Andy, I'll start with you. Cooking meat with fire, such a nice idea.
I mean, I think it's built into our DNA from our ancestors who ate some meat that was hit by lightning is kind of the start of it. So it's risky. And you never know. It's like a concert. You never know if is it going to be perfect or exact. It's always changing, and just it's pretty exciting to me.
So when you say it's risky, it's interesting because when I think about a restaurant, and we're in the smoke shop right now, you've got to do things more or less the same every day because the customers
yes.
sort of expect it, right?
Yes, so consistency is important.
So that's got to be tricky when you talk about cooking with risky fire.
It is, and it's quite challenging. Unlike sous vide. Which we can dial in our temperature and hold our meat to exactly as it needs to be and then pick it up. We really have to pay attention to what we're doing and it kind of ebbs and flows and constantly checking to make sure it's perfect as it needs to be.
Chris, what about your journey?
Yeah,
what attracts you to cooking meat with fire?
I think it's a lot of times you end up in the same place, a perfectly cooked brisket, but the way that you get there can be different every single time. And while the recipes in this book and really any barbecue recipe tends to be a little bit more of a guideline, and really what being a pitmaster about is, and what's great about cooking meat with fire is trusting your senses and developing your senses. You know, how does the smoke smell? How does the bark appear? What is the sound of the crispy skin on a whole hog? And you can develop those senses, and it's the kind of thing that you only get from years and years of repetition. That's what kind of a pit master is. That doesn't mean you can't get started with just a few hours of experience under your belt as well, though.
Is this book for the novice, relatively inexperienced backyard barbecue person? Is that the idea?
We have this recipe called the 3-2-1 ribs, which Chris helped develop, and anybody can follow this recipe, and anybody will make some of the best ribs they'll ever have the first time out. But what the cool part about that is, the second time out and the third time out, it will be better and better. Like anything, I know sometimes today people want to just make it and it's fantastic, but a lot of things take practice. You could tell me how to do your job, but I don't think I can do your job tomorrow.
Yeah, I'm still trying to figure out how to do my job. So 3-2-1 ribs. What's the sort of key thing to understand about making delicious ribs, Chris?
The key with all barbecue really is controlling your fire. You don't want to have a grill or a smoker where the temperature is up and down and up and down. You have a nice, consistent, clean fire. You're looking for some thin blue smoke coming out of your stack, not billowing white smoke. You want smoke to be an element of the flavor profile, just like chili powder or salt or any seasoning.
And what does the 3-2-1 refer to?
Three is 3 hours in smoke, 2 hours wrapped, protected from the smoke where the meat can kind of tenderize, and then 1 hour out of the wrap to crisp up the bark.
Huh. Now, you're talking about a smoker. So I'm guessing that a lot of folks that think about, throwing the odd steak or chicken on the backyard grill don't have a smoker. Is it an easy thing to get? What do you recommend?
You know, we're big fans of live fire. So we like charcoal and wood or wood chunk, and we try to stay away from gas when we're talking about barbecue. For a quick, easy one is a Weber Smoky Mountain.
Yeah, the Weber's a great choice. If you have a kettle grill, one of the great ways to use a kettle grill is to build a two-zone fire, turn all the vents down a lot, and just let it kind of smolder and burn very lightly on one side. Put the meat on the other side and crack a beer and clear your afternoon. And that's a big part of what this cooking process is. There's easier ways than spending 8 hours cooking a rack of ribs some afternoon to make a meal for a Sunday dinner. But that's not the only reason you cook barbecue.
And you've created a nice excuse to just hang out and have a beer.
Absolutely. Yeah.
It's not necessarily easy. And I don't know if we really want it to be easy. Like, if you want to have the best ribs at your tailgate, yeah, it's going to take a little bit of hard work.
So we're going to go into your kitchen and do something, right?
Yeah, we're going to go in and we're going to talk about brisket.
Beautiful. Let's head in there.
Yeah. Is that cutting board around somewhere?
Yeah.
It already smells amazing in here. And I know it's, what is it, 9:30 in the morning?
Yeah, it's just all day, though. And you end up smelling like this all day, every day. We get our briskets from Aurora Farms. Awesome. Thank you.
Oh, look at that. Gorgeous.
Yeah, it's a gorgeous piece of meat. You want to, you know, respect this gorgeous piece of meat and not screw it up. We want to maybe light seasoning and an understated smoke and really respect it over about a 14-hour cook for you guys
here? Yeah, it's about an hour a pound we're cooking.
Wow.
250 degrees.
So is your smoker going pretty much all the time?
About 24 hours a day. What's going to happen now is we're going to pull out. We open this up. I can show you what's happening here.
Anyone you want me to grab here, Andy?
I think anyone should be good. I mean,
oh my God! The smell coming out of this oven the is so delicious.
What you can see here is it's black, golden, brown. This is the caramelization, a deep, deep, deep caramelization. Salt, some peppers, and the smoke.
So, Chris, what went on there in terms of the rub?
Andy got this beautiful bark, and it's really almost only salt and pepper.
Wow.
That's really one of the hallmarks of one of the things you're looking for, like, sensually as you're cooking a piece of brisket, is the appearance of the bark.
So yeah. You've got this dark bark, as you call it, but it's also the juices are coming out from the inside,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, even on that lean part of the flat, that is somewhat of a lean piece of meat, you can see the juices kind of bubbling up into the into the bark.
It's beautiful.
And it's, I'm going to slice it here. What kind of accumulates as you process a dozen briskets or 20 briskets over a service is the little scraps on the side of the board. And these little burnt ends kind of accumulate. Some Kansas City restaurants just started giving them out as little snacks while people waited in line. And over time, it kind of developed and people said, you know what, that's the best part of the brisket.
I've heard these described as meat candy.
Everything that's great about a brisket or a piece of barbecue is super intensified in these burnt ends.
Right, I'm going to try one, okay?
Yeah, you should.
All right.
It's almost too much, right?
No, but it's delicious.
It's almost too smoky, almost too salty.
Not for me. It's great. But now, you wouldn't recommend this for the home cook, because this is, I mean, this literally took an entire day in a smoker, right?
Not on your first project.
I wouldn't recommend
trying to cook a brisket for a big, you know, Sunday dinner when you've never cooked one before and you have, you know, 15 people coming over. Probably not the best time.
Yeah, but we would strongly suggest you try it.
Let me ask you about the sort of tradition of the regional tradition of this kind of cooking, because I think a lot of people would think of this kind of smoking meats as a southern tradition. Does it belong here in New England? By belong, I mean, is there a tradition here in New England to do this?
Texas-style barbecue, North Carolina-style barbecue, Kansas City barbecue. It's as red, white, and blue American as it gets. And one of the things that we kind of thought about was, can new styles of barbecue evolve?
In my opinion, it is the only true American cuisine.
Well, thanks for letting us taste this great American tradition.
Thanks for coming.
So that's Andy Husband, chef and owner of The Smoke Shop in Cambridge and co-author with Chris Hart of Pitmaster Recipes, Techniques, and Barbecue Wisdom. Chris Hart, Andy Husband, thank you both very much.
Thanks for coming.
All that meat and no potatoes.
I know what I'm having for dinner. You can find recipes for Andy and Chris's 321 ribs and butcher paper brisket on our website at radioboston.org. That's it for today. Radio Boston's a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Anthony Brooks. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.
With all that meat and new potatoes, I don't think that peas are bad.
With me, most anything goes.
I look in the pot, I'm fit to fight. 'Cause woman, you know that mess ain't right. All that meat.